No, I guess Bill Mitchell, in looking back on my experiences with him, is just he's a typical GM guy, and he's got GM blood coursing through his veins, and he's very loyal to the corporation, and doesn't feel that anybody in the world make cars like General Motors, and I guess that's been ingrained in him since the day that Harley Earl hired him, and he's a product of all that, and that coupled with the fact that he is very flamboyant, as I mentioned, and very opinionated, I think he would have been the same way had he stayed in New York and worked for the ad agencies or been involved in advertising. But
what's your opinion of him as a designer?
I think he's a good designer, an excellent designer. As a matter of fact, he was there when he was required to be there. What I mean by that is that in the mid-30s, when Harley Earl was leaning on all of his top people to get the very most out of them, and by the way, there was a guy that did do that. Harley Earl was a great manipulator of people, and I say that in a kindly term, not as a malicious sort of thing by any means, because again, the job was so big and there was so much to do, and there was, particularly in the early 30s when they were out to become the styling kings of the world, or the styling mark to shoot for, he had to rely on the Bill Mitchells and Frank Hershey's and Bob Lowers and all the others that were excellent designers in their own right. And built the 38 Cadillac with the limousine doors, and I don't know if that was developed in a body studio. I suspect that it was, although, as I say, when I got there in 48, the body studios were operating very important manner, about as important as anything, because that's where the packages were developed and all of that. And I suspect that those limousine doors and Bill Mitchell's input into that, he's been given the credit for it. I have no reason to doubt that. But he could have been working in one of the studios that developed that C-body. But that was really a breakthrough, and those cars today are revered to be classics. You know, they really are. And they carried that same basic body design for many years, with different grills and hoods and fenders and running boards or semi-running boards, pontoon fenders. But that was one of Bill Mitchell's marks. And the 41 Cadillac, which is, I always thought was a superb looking car for its era, for its day. He was very much involved in that. And that grill, and in fact, I just looked in the Old Cars Weekly or something here. There's a 41 Cadillac convertible in there for $49,000. And there's a car that probably cost about $4,000, I would guess. Maybe not even that. Oh, I'm sure that's high. Probably closer to $3,000, even being a convertible. It's a coupe, it isn't a convertible sedan, but they made the sedans then too last year. But Bill was heavily involved in those cars that really are looked upon today as being classics, many of them. And of course, overseeing all of this and getting what he wanted and doing it the right way was Harley, who was the man of the times too, certainly when Sloan brought him in from California, relocated him and set him up in styling and gave him fantastic horsepower to do these cars, because Sloan really is the guy that deserves an enormous amount of credit for recognizing the fact that in the dark days of the 20s, when cars, almost all of them were ugly, you can't find an early 20s car that really is very good looking in general, particularly the sedans. There were some, you know, a convertible is good looking almost any year, but or a roadster, a convertible sedan or whatever. The open cars are always easier to do, and they look better generally. But when Sloan could see that his ugly period was there, and he knew that cars were going to go far beyond where they were at that point, and they needed some artistic endeavors in there to clean these things up, because the engineers were designing them all with T-squares and straight edges and vertical windshields and vertical side glass, and so they needed somebody to grab hold of things and do it right. And this whole industrial design, kind of a automotive industrial design, was coming into being in the 20s. And although there had been designers way before that, there was a guy by the name of Finley Robertson Porter, who was an engineer, but he was also a damn good, he had a good feel for design, and of course did the 35J Mercer, again a convertible. He had very few sedans in the burgeoning days of the automobile, as you know. And so almost everything was either a roadster or a touring, whatever. But there were some excellent designers, and that's why some of the early cars are good-looking cars today. The one that I just showed you, Dave, in my garage here was done by Fred Tone, and that was a handsome automobile, and it appeals to a designer today because of the height of the hood versus the radiator, and it had a suspension system with the springs on top of the frame rather than under it, and that took some designing in those days. Somebody had some good feel for shapes and form and contours and proportions and all those things.
Which model was that?
And well, that's a 1907 American Underslung, but there were good-looking cars and ugly cars in any period in time. And you'll find generally that the good-looking cars are looked upon today as kind of classics, and the bad ones, you can't give them away, you know, the ugly ones. Case in point, you know, Gordon Buick's famous Cord and his LeBaron Duesenbergs and all the others that he had a hand in. He's a fantastic designer, and they'll go down in history as such.
But, back to Earl. What would be your opinion of his place in design?
I guess if you had to sum it up in one statement, you'd have to say that he's really the father of automobile design as such, commercial automobile design. There were always, you know, the Dietrichs and the LeBaron body designers and things of that type, and Fowler, Earl, that guy's got one of his books. And there was, of course, Gordon Buick and all these other guys. But if you wanted to pick one guy out that really made it a profession, that really, really made it a profession and put it on the map, it'd have to be Harley Earl. There's no question about it.
Brought it into the 20th century.
Exactly.
Made the stylist respected.
That's right. Yeah, he made it a profession. It was, you know, it's just a bunch of guys that were in the... I've got some old Pierce Arrow catalogs, and they mention styling in there. They don't use that term, but they say their art department will do cars to your specific request. And they're speaking there about picking out the upholstering if you want a brocade or a frise or whatever. And or if you want a specific color on the car, a combination that were great on three tones and four tones and five tones in those days, and the color of the stripe that goes with the blue or the gray or whatever. And so styling has been a piece of automobile design since the Kerr-Dash-Olds. But it really became a profession under Harley Earl, and he really made it, gave it some credibility, and did the job for the designers.
It took a strong personality like his to take it out of the hands of the body engineers.
Exactly, yeah. And that's exactly what he did, because Sloan gave him that horsepower, and he had many, many battles. I haven't gotten his book. I've got to get that, Dave. I really have to. In fact, I'm going to get one of those before I even leave Michigan there. But there's a book on him. I haven't read it. I've only seen it. And,
is it the Harley Earl and the Dream Machine?
Yes. Uh-huh. Have you read it?
I've looked at it. We haven't talked about
it. Yeah, I've got to get that. I don't. I have to assume it's well done. I hope it is. But the stories of Harley Earl are legendary. They really are. He had so many. He was such a character. He was a big guy, number one. He was huge. He was 6 foot something. I don't know, 6 foot five or six. I know he had these kind of pale blue eyes that when he'd look at you, boy, I'll tell you, he'd look right through you, because he was a very powerful guy, and he carried that power throughout all of the meetings and all of the mountains that he had to climb to get what he wanted, to get the cars lower. In those days, they were 75 inches high, and he was trying to get them down to, you know, 5 feet. And of course, some cars would come out, like the front-wheel drive Ruxton and others. I'm sure that positive that he had to have used those as examples of what he was after. I know I heard tales that they had Ruxton as one example, he had one of those brought in and put alongside of the current 31, 32 vehicles that they were building in those days, and said, you know, guys, we've got to get these cars down, they've got to be sleek, we've got to have the windshields raked, and they got to have a side glass pulled in at the top, and he got that, but took a lot of salesmanship on his part to do it.
What were your personal experiences with Harley Earl?
Well, I've had a few of them. The one that I remember most, I don't know if I mentioned this on our talk at work, the elevator incident.
I don't think we got enough tape. Would you mind repeating that?
No, I'm glad to. Well, this was about 1949, and Harley Earl commanded such respect and really, I guess, almost terror throughout the group there. He was so big and he was so powerful and he could fire you with just a wave of a hand, you know.
Apparently did.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. He fired many guys because of one thing or another. Some of the things were probably not really that important. But anyway, I thought this was the day that he was going to fire several people. John Foster, Homer Lagasse, myself, and I think Bob Shulk was in the elevator, too. And John Foster had gotten on. He wasn't in the old studios, I recall, at that time. But anyway, it was about 5, 6 o'clock at night. And we'd gotten on the elevator. We were on the elevator. And Harley Earl got on a lower floor. And we had been talking, and the elevator was going down from floor to floor. And Harley, the elevator stopped. Doors opened up, and here's Harley. Almost had to duck to get under the entrance to get into the elevator. And he had these two huge boxes under each. I think what they were, we talked about this later. I think there were probably a couple sets of wheel covers that he picked up for his friends or something. And somebody wrapped them all neatly in this brown paper, and they were taped up and everything. And he had one under each arm. And the elevator went clear down to the basement where his car was. And of course we knew that, and he took the elevator daily. And here he was in his Palm Beach suit, his tan suit, which he liked, very light suits usually, or light gray. He was a handsome guy, he really was a different looking guy. He really was kind of different looking. Straight hair and not much of it, and a comb straight back. And he always had a superb tan. He was. I don't know how tall he was. He had to be 6'6" at least. At least. Get out of here, man. That's a sign to get the cat. Anyway.
Muscular too.
Oh yeah, they get a lot of exercise doing that. Get the kitty off. So the elevator opens up. Harley gets out of these two boxes, and we got down about two floors. And Homer Lagasse made the classic remark of the century. And he said, how are you, Mr. Earl? Looking up at him, he said, I see you just cashed your check. And Harley Earl never said one word for the next 5 or 6 floors. He just looked from one individual to the other one. He looked at Homer, number one, looked at Johnny Foster, myself, Bob Shulk, and then back at Homer, and he was trying to zero in on Homer because he wasn't very good on names, and I'm sure that he was mentally deciding that he was gonna fire everybody in that elevator, and starting with Homer, and he'd probably fire him twice. But Homer, if you know him, he's a master of the wisecrack, and the elevator stopped at the ground floor. We got off quickly. And I look back, and Harley Earl is still in that elevator with those piercing eyes just glancing over all four of us there, trying to figure, you know, what time should he get in the morning and who he should talk to about getting us relieved of our jobs. Didn't do it.
He did?
Nope. I never heard another word of it. No. Nope. Mr. Earl, did you just cash your check? Wow. It is a great story. But he was not very much at giving speeches. I heard him one time over at the New Center Building. He was giving a celebration or some event they had down there. Had some cars down there, and he was asked to give a few words. And he He was really not very good at giving speeches at all, nor did he want to give speeches. He'd avoid it at all costs. He'd give presentations to small groups, you know, the divisional people and stuff, and he was very good at that. But when it came to an audience, he really he didn't like to do it, and he didn't do a very good job, and he mispronounced words. He had a terrible job, had terrible times pronouncing aluminum, like my son. He can't pronounce it either. But he would call it aluminum, and or aluminum. And he had a terrible time with certain words. And everybody couldn't remember names very well, fortunately, because of the elevator situation. And that's why he used to call everybody fella. Impressions of him?
Well, it's just sort of a final evaluation of his impact on science.
Well, again, he's the father of the profession, really. There's no question about that. And I think the guy deserves all the credit in the world. I remember the last time I saw him was down at a race at Daytona, and it was about 2 years before he died, maybe a year. And I was down there with my son, Rick, my oldest one. And he, I went up and I wanted to introduce Rick to him, because there he was with his Palm Beach suit again and his great tan. And I went up and he knew who I was for sure. But I introduced my son Rick to him, and I said, "This is Mr. Earl, and he's the one that really gave me my first start in this business, and I'd like to have you meet him." So Harley turned to me, and he put his hand on my son's shoulder, and he said, "You ought to be real proud of your dad." He said, he's a good designer." And he said, "Boy," he said, "I'm proud to have been able to give him a start." And he started back in, you remember the year, 1948. So, but everybody used to, nobody called him Harley. In fact, if they'd written a book, they probably should have called it, they never called him Harley. Never called him Henry, never called him Harley. But anyway, everybody called him Mr. Earl. It was one word, Mr. Earl. Hi, Mr. Earl. He did command respect from everybody, and a little bit of terror in there, too, because he could have eliminated it with just a call of the secretary, and did, I think, on a number of occasions of various individuals. I know one much talked about story that I don't know if it's ever been in print or not, but he used to take a January or February vacation down in Florida. He had a house down there. In fact, I think he died down there. But when he was gone, of course, everybody breathed a little bit of a sigh of relief, because but he left enough assignments to not let you sit around on your thumbs, because he had plenty of things for you to do while he was gone. And of course, I was just a designer on the board at that time, but he would leave all these assignments to the head of the division, Stanley Division Studios. And when he came back, everybody knew when he was going and when he was coming back. And every once in a while, he'd come in, he'd fly in from Florida if he had a thought on something, and he wasn't much. I never saw a Harley Earl sketch. He must have been able to sketch, but nobody, to my knowledge, has ever seen an original Harley Earl drawing. But I'll tell you, you could show him a wall full of drawings, and he'd pick out the best one every time. There's no question about it. He really knew a good line when he saw it. And he knew how to get from point A to point B with modelers. And in the early days, so I'm told, that he used to sit down in his director's chair alongside the model and have these guys change the clay and change the plasters and the drawings and everything else, and working with them when he was, you know, first starting in the late 20s and early 30s. But so this one time when he had been down in Florida, and he'd come back, and of course the tom-toms had already, and the smoke signals had already heralded his coming, and we knew when he was in one studio, and when he'd leave that studio, the guy'd call the next guy and say, "Hey, he's gone from Cadillac to Buick to Olds to Pontiac to Chevrolet," and they were all lined up in that sequence. And then, of course, there were the body studios, too. There were several, several body studios and accessory studios and medallion studios and so forth. They had a huge staff. They still do. They had 1,400 people or something. So they had all these different areas, and he would visit every one of them when he'd come back from his sojourn down in Florida. So this one time, I was in the old studio at that time, but for some reason or other, I was in Bob Lauer's studio when he arrived, and the word had arrived. I think I was filling in or something. He used everybody for fire as firemen over there. They'd be in one studio, somebody was on a leave of absence or sick or on vacation or whatever. They would bounce these guys around, as I mentioned earlier.
Was that
so,
L-A-U-E-R?
L-A-U-R. Lauer. L-A-U-R, I believe. L-A-U-R. Lauer. Well, I don't think so. There might have been the end. I can find that out. But anyway, Lauer had the Pontiac studio, and I was in there for this the fill-in job, because that was my normal assignment. I was in Oldsmobile most of my professional years over there. So the word came through to Lauer, and of course we made great preparations while Harley was gone for the 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever it was. And we had this A-body that we were working on, and it was sitting in the studio. The clay model was there, and it was in the platform. Of course, didn't take it out of the platform. We had all the drawings set up around it, and what the concept was and what it was going to look like, and the preliminary drawings that we'd done right after Harley left after his assignment. And so this was Harley's turn to come in and criticize the car. And while we were handed the body from the body, one of the body studios, we'd, you know, put the fenders on it and the deck and the taillights and all the other things. And so there it was, sitting there, ready for the master's review. And the word had gotten out. He had just left Buick, and he was on his way to Pontiac. Had left Ned Nichols, and he was coming in to see Bob Lauer. So Bob walks up to the door, and boy, he no sooner got there than you could hear the keys from him. He had his own set of keys, of course. He'd come in there and sneak around. We always wanted to set bear traps for him at night. Never did it. But anyway, he would come in and look at the cars after everybody else had gone home. And I think that goes back to the elevator thing. I think he'd been hawking around there, lurking around there, doing something that night, and then he just decided to take the wheel covers home in the elevator. But anyway, the door opens up. Harley has got this Quasimodo with the keys, and open up the door, and everybody's standing there. You know, the designers are all at their boards, diligently working. The modelers were over filing their tools or working on something, or standing next to the model to make the changes that were inevitable. And Harley Earl opened the door, looked in, and greeted Bob Lauer and his assistant. I can't recall at this time. The two guys were standing there in order of importance, Bob first and the assistant second. Modelers were out. The place was spick and span. The clay had been slicked down with water. And the clay was just glistening. It was really a good job. Everything was neat, spick and span, and ready to be criticized. So Harley Earl comes in, he stands there, he didn't say anything for a couple minutes. Looked at the car, and he walked over, and he walked to the front of the car, he walked to the side, he walked to the rear, and then he walked back to the middle of the room, and Bob Lauer is following him around, and the assistant's following him, Lauer. And he said, "You know, fellas," he said, "I'm from Pasadena." And he said, "A little old lady in Pasadena would walk into one of those ARF showrooms out there, Pontiac showroom, and she'd look at that car, and she'd say, 'I wouldn't buy that son of a bitch.'" So that's a typical Harleyism. But he was very straightforward, and boy, I'll tell you, when he left, that car was a different automobile by the time he got out of there. And he would, he'd usually say, "I'd come back." And he'd look at the car and get it all in his mind's eye, and then he'd go away, and then he'd come back that night, usually, and really look at it much closer quarters. And then he would call Bob Lauer into his office and tell him what he really wanted to do with that car, or he'd come down and walk around the car and have the modelers change it while he watched.
So the change orders came through verbally.
Oh yeah, no sketches, no memos. No, he was not big on that at all. In fact, I never saw his memo or a sketch that he had ever made, because he could literally, he could look at a car and he could tell you what was wrong with it. And he's usually right. He had such a great grasp of form and shape, and very commercial. The things that he did, he's been criticized for laying chrome on with a trowel and other things. But it was commercial. Everything he did had a public appeal to the guy that was going to buy the car. Almost everything. And he overdid things a lot of times, particularly the last vehicles that Harley was connected with. It's really kind of sad, because that was the 58 series. And that 58, B58, I think they called it, a Buick, that had chrome. I had left GM 5 years before that. But that car was, that limited Buick was probably the worst example. It looked like a rolling Lichty cartoon. Lichty was the guy that used to do the cartoons, the big fins and stuff. And he was a cartoonist that really went after the automobile industry, particularly with the fins later. But that vehicle, in 58, is really kind of sad that Harley had to go out on a note like that, because those cars were, almost all of the 58s were just so adorned, from the Corvette, which put the strips down the deck, and it was just, chrome was, it would almost have been easier to chrome the whole car and then paint it, mask it off and paint it in spots. I'm being facetious, obviously, but that was the year of the ultimate chrome, the golden age of GORP, as I call it, Jerry Flint's book, and he quotes me in there saying it.
Is that your expression?
Yeah.
Really?
I've had two or three people ask me through the years, what is GORP? I don't know what it is. It's just junk, I guess. Or
junk is
different. Yeah, I suppose, but it's too bad, because Harley was such a moving force within the design profession, and then to have that as his last hurrah was really kind of too bad.
Well, you are getting rest of this point at GM. Are you thinking of
phone.
So how is your career going at GM at this point? Are you you've worked in two or three studios and worked for two or three people?
Yeah, I left there. I was having an increasingly difficult time with Art Ross. Mm-hmm. He was a guy that would pick on you. It wasn't just limited to me. He'd pick on Stebbins or Legassi or whoever happened to be there. And I think at that time Foster was in the studio. And I'd been in there for several months. And he was the kind of a guy that you had to agree with him like 100%. If it was 98, then you were against him. It wasn't that you had an opinion of your own, you were against whatever he felt was the way to go. And you immediately became somebody that he should start needling. And that's not good. You know that the association isn't going to last. So I asked for a transfer. And I talked to Ducharme again. I said, look, Art and I aren't really getting along. It's not his fault. It's not my fault. It's just a clash of personalities. And he said, and he was, Ducharme was a kind of a two-faced son of a gun. And he would try to draw you out. And I never really badmouthed Art, because I knew better than that. But I said, look, it's just a personal thing between he and I, and I just rather transfer to either to Bill Mitchell's or Lauer or McKeegan or Ned Nichols, anybody. I said, I'm not a difficult guy to get along with, and I'm not a personality problem. They have those, and I've had them too in the past, for sure. But you can work with these guys, and you can, but anyway, Art Ross evidently had a meeting with Ducharme, and Ducharme said to me, he said, well, I don't think it's any problem. He said, gosh, I've been in there for 6 or 8 months, and we'd like to move the guys around anyway, and where would you like to work? And I said, well, any of the ones that I mentioned, I'd like. He said, I'd even go back and work for Frank Hershey, and because they had a spot open at that time, an assistant over at the Planet 8. And I'd gotten along fine with both Ed Anderson and Hershey, and I said, look, anywhere you want me to work. So anyway, the next thing I knew, Ducharme had evidently talked to Art Ross, and Art Ross says, well, I think you got to fire the guy. And so he did. They let me go. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because my mother was ill at that time. I was going with Marion, my wife, to be. I thought, God, this is a peg point in my life. These guys have done me a favor. You know, the war was, Korean War was on, and it was starting to get really hot. And so I said, well, I'll go back to California. I'll marry this gal I'd have been going with for a year. And my mother was not in good shape at all at that time. And Mrs. Smith, a colored lady who I'd hired to take care of her, was getting old herself, and she had problems, health problems. So I thought, well, this is a peg point in my life, and I'm gonna get married. I'm gonna load my one antique car, which I had at that time. So this was a kind of a key point in my life, and I actually felt liberated because I was under a lot of tension with this guy because he was a needler. He would needle you. You know, he'd give you things to do, and without even looking at the drawing, he'd tell you it was no good. Or, you know, do a full-size rendering, Teague. Get up off your board and do a full-size rendering rather than a small one. Or if I was doing a large one, do a small one. Or he was riding me. You know, he knew damn well that I was going to ask for a transfer, and that gave him the opening to get me transferred out of the corporation. So, and I hadn't been there that long anyway, in the corporation. So, I thought, well, okay. I had some severance money, and I'd saved some money. And I had my old 88 coupe. I had my 03 Ford in the trailer. And I had my girl. And so I said, well, okay, let's get married, honey. So we did. We got married, and we moved. By this time, Hershey had left the corporation, and he had moved to Taos, New Mexico. And he'd started a business out there, and he was doing very well with it. And so I thought, well, we'll stop by and see Frank, because he liked Marion, and I liked Kate, his wife. And we got along really well socially, because Frank's a neat guy. And and he started this business there, and I thought, well, that's a point. It's about a three-quarter way to California, or two-thirds. And we'll use that as kind of a mark. So I loaded the 03 Ford and got all my worldly possessions and put them in the trunk of the car. I didn't have many at that time. And Mary and I got married, and Chuck Jordan came to the wedding, many others that I now am friends with again. I mean, after I came back, of course, I renewed all my acquaintances. So we went to California, and I stopped by, and we spent two or three days with Kate and Frank Hershey, and got out there and got my mom situated, and Marion was working for a while out there. She's a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to work for an outfit called Rhodes Lewis, which was they say the war was on and the Korean thing was heating up and looked like that was going to get kind of nasty.
How do you spell that country?
Rhodes Lewis, R-H-O-D-E-S / Lewis, L-E-W-I-S.
What did they do?
They were making proposals for sauna buoys and rocket launchers and all kinds of weapons things. It was run by a guy named Alvin Kornblum. And he started this Rhodes Lewis thing. I guess he bought out the company or something, and then he was trying to get contracts, and they were making proposals. I was involved in doing all kinds of prospective drawings and design drawings and suggestions for weapon systems.
Proposals,
yeah. And I've still got a lot of those kicking around. So then I'm in California and working for Rhodes Lewis. And in the meantime, Frank and Kate, or Kate used to write to Marion, and we'd call once in a while. And he decided he wanted to get back in the automobile business. And so he was making brass castings, a very artistic guy, and he was doing trivets and all kinds of brass castings. He always liked brass anyway. And casting. And he'd done some of that out here at a place called Winkler Mill Farm in Rochester when he worked for GM. And so he had this little business going, and he wanted to get out of it after he left GM. I don't know what circumstance he left GM under, but anyway, he did leave. And I couldn't hardly believe that when I heard it, because God, he was such a part of Harley's team. But yet he was, I think Ross had something to do with that too, because he was a nasty little character. He was always politically trying to undermine everybody and everything. guy that Harley knew. But anyway, Frank didn't stay out in Taos too long, and Mary and I were out there for about a year, I guess. And I got a call one night from Detroit. Frank had told me that he was going to take a job with Packard. And this was in 53, I guess. 52 or 53. And he, John Reinhardt had just left to go to Ford to design, as it turns out, the new Continental. He's got an early start on that one. It came out in 56, but they worked on it for several years before that. Yeah, this guy, Frank Hershey, has been very instrumental in my life. Really, you know, got me started at General Motors, and then gave me this call about, God, I don't know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning or something. It's 11 out there in California. But anyway, he called me very early in the morning. I remember that for sure. And he said that he had left Taos, near Santa Fe, actually. And he had couldn't get automobiles out of his system, and he'd taken this job at Packard as a working for Ed McCauley, who was the head of styling at that time. And Ed was a neat guy, by the way. But anyway,
he was... Brother of Alvin, was he?
Yes, brother of Alvin. Alvin, I guess, is still around, but Ed is long gone. But was a very charming and wonderful gentleman. But anyway, he said he was working for Ed McCauley, and that John Reinhardt had just left to go to Ford, and that there was a job opening, and if I wanted to take it, I could come back as chief stylist for Packard. And I'd kind of missed working on cars too, for sure, and the whole Detroit scene. And Marion's mother, is her parents, they were both living at that time, were of course down in Pennsylvania, and this is a lot closer to Pennsylvania than California. So she was all for it. My mother was understanding as usual. And she said, no, I think you ought to take it. You got a job to go back there, and you like cars, and why don't you go back and work for Mr. Hershey again? So I did that, and sold the car out there, and bought another car, and put the 03 Ford and brought it back. This is about 8 months later, a year later, I guess. So I started into work at Packard, replacing John Reinhardt. And then Hershey left. God, he left and went to Ford. And that left me working directly for Ed McCauley, who I dearly loved. He was a neat guy. God, a neat guy. I liked his wife, who was a charming woman, and his kids and all that. But anyway, so Frank defected from Packard and went to Ford, and ultimately did the 55 T-Bird. He and Bill Boyer and some other guys did that over there. And
what year did he leave?
Geez, I gotta remember now, Dave. It has to be 50. I didn't work for him very damn long at Packard. I mean, it was like 3 months or something, and he was gone because he really wanted to be at one of the larger companies. And so I don't think I worked with him at Packard for more than about 2 or 3 months. And he left and went to Ford, and they had this big program on. They not only hired Reinhardt away from Packard, they hired Frank away from Packard. And because he kind of, in effect, somewhat replaced Reinhardt also along with me. But they wanted to build up the staff at Packard, so they wanted to get more top management people in there. And so he went, it had to be, to answer your question, it had to be about 50, early 53 or late 52. Because the first project he had over there was a 55 T-Bird, and you figured 2 years in advance of that, so it had to be 52, 53.
What was the economic situation at Packard at this time?
Chaotic.
Was it?
Yeah, I didn't know it, but when I took the job at Packard, they were Lamort. They were dying. They were terminal. It wasn't going to be possible to save. The 51 Packard had come out, and of course I facelifted that. Frank had had a start on it, but then he left, and I left it out to me and the guys that worked for me at that time, Charlie Faneuf and Bob Jones, and got a lot of other guys, neat guys. And we got along fine. We didn't have a very large crew there. I think we had 14, 15 people, maybe 20. I can't remember how many. Well, counting the modders, we would have had at least 20. But it was a small operation. And John DeLorean, by the way, worked there.
Really?
And along with Herb Misch, who also left and went to Ford.
Body engineers, were they?
Well, Herb Misch became chief engineer for Ford later.
But
they were at, John was in transmissions with Forrest McFarland, as I recall. And, but he was restless even then. He wanted to get out. You know, he knew he wasn't going to be there long. He was a good-looking son of a gun in those days. And my secretary, Sally, I can't remember her last name. She had a German name about 3 inches long. But she had the hots so bad for John that it was just, he was really a handsome guy. And he had this great personality. And
she had a lot of company.
Yes, yes. And that's right. And he had his first wife at that time. That's before he married Kelly Harmon. But I know his first wife was a very attractive gal, too. Anyway, this my secretary really, really had the hots for that guy. I'll never forget that. He'd call up before he'd come down and look at some of the cars. She'd answer the phone, and she'd come in and see me. She said, "Mr. DeLorean is coming down to see you." But anyway. We did a lot of facelifts on that car that Reinhardt really had done, the 51 Packard, and he did a good job on it. We were working with some outside consultants, quite a number of them at that time at Packard. We were working with Reese Miller, two guys who I knew very well because of my California Paul Brown kind of a thing, because they were out there at that time. And they were influencing me, too, and encouraging me to come back to Detroit. This is going bouncing back a little bit here to the Northrop days, because they were friends of Paul Brown and Reese Miller and Grissinger, Buzz Grissinger, were very encouraging to me, or supportive of trying to convince me I ought to come back to Detroit, which I did, of course. But anyway, I was at Packard for quite a number of years, and as I say, we had a lot of help. Nance, when he came in, he was going to be the savior of the corporation. We were going to do this grand 55 Packard. And while I was there, Ed McCauley left, and I don't know under what circumstances, but I think he wanted to take early retirement. And he left, and there was just me and running the department. And as I say, there weren't a lot of people there. But then when Nance came in, he brought in Bill Schmidt, and he hired him back from Ford. So we had one that was on our side from Ford. And Bill's a good guy, neat guy, good friend today. And Bill was brought in as VP, the first VP of styling, because Ed was director of styling, and I was chief stylist. And so when Ed left, there was a period in there that where I was reporting directly to Nance. But Nance had heard about this hot designer, Bill Schmidt, who had done this forthcoming car. This wasn't out then, but the 55 Lincoln and the 54 Lincoln. And he was an up-and-coming designer, had his own business and so forth. And great reputation, Bill Schmidt. So he brought him in and lured him over there with a VP. Although Bill, I think, once he got over there, he realized that we were in such tough financial straits that probably not a great career move for him. But it was a good one for me because I was just starting up the ladder. I was a little older, not much, but 5 years or something. In any event, Bill and I got along great, got along really good. And he also hired a guy by the name of Duncan McCrae, who just passed away this year. And once Studebaker was formed in that same 2 or 3 year time period in there, Duncan McCrae was given. He was chief stylist for Studebaker, and I was chief stylist for Packard, working under Bill Schmidt. And we did some really good cars at that time. Most of them didn't get off the ground. But the 55 Packard was done at that point in time. Bear in mind, you go backward again about a year. While I was working directly for Nance, before Bill came in, Nance wanted a facelift of 54 Packer to make it into a 55 because we had the V8 engine coming in. We had Bill Allison's torsion suspension coming in. Although we didn't have the money to do an all-new body, this was going to be a wrap windshield, as that was all a rage those days. So we, with Mish's help, wrapped the windshield, wrapped the windshield around, kept the doors, which was almost a miracle to be able to do that. But anyway, changed the upper door frames, and but kept the lower doors, and wrapped the windshield around and put a dog leg in it and did all those good things, new front fenders and hood and deck and backlight and a lot of other things, new instrument panel. So it was a very heavy, a very, very heavy facelifted vehicle, the 55 Packard. Yeah. In fact, I still have the drawing that I made for the 55 taillights, so-called cathedral taillights, because it was like in you know, January, February, March, and April that Nance was wanted. He was back there. He was a white goods guy. He came from a washer, dryer, fridger. What the devil did he come from? White. Anyway, it's white goods. But anyway, he had no automobile experience at all, and he couldn't understand the timing problems that we had with the automobile industry versus the white goods industry that he had come from. And as a result, he put down these almost impossible time frames to do things in. And he knew that we were fighting for our lives over there, you know, to try to, at 1580 East Grand Boulevard, to try to save the corporation. The dealers were hungry for new cars. V8s were coming in. We had this old straight eight, albeit a good straight eight, but it was still an old-fashioned L-head engine. He wanted a brand new overhead valve V8, like all the rest of the guys had, felt that we needed, he was right. Wanted this great suspension system that Allison had come up with. And he had Herb Misch, who was a very competent engineer that was going to put all this stuff together. And so we spawned the 55 Packard from the 54 body by doing all the things I mentioned.
Let me ask a question here at this moment, Dick. Who brought James J. Nance into Packard, and who thought he was going to be the savior of the company?
I'm not sure I can answer that because I was back on Concord Avenue and into the building down there, and all these high-level moves were being made up front and with the board of directors and things of that type. And Hugh Furry was the head man at Packard at the time I went there. And there were rumors that this hotshot guy from the Midwest was coming in. It turned out to be James Nance. And he was really going to set the place on fire, and he's going to save the corporation. And they're going to have new cars for the dealers and all that stuff. But I don't know who actually pushed the button and brought him in. I really don't. I can't answer that.
Was Alvin McCauley still head of the company this time?
No. Alvin McCauley was not the head of the company at that time. Yeah, he left. Had died, in fact. And I don't know when he passed away, but I think it was the late 40s, somewhere in that range. But I'm not sure when he died. But there was a fellow before that by the name of Christopher, whom Ferry replaced, and I was really not privy to that information as to how they first approached Nance and got him to move and all that stuff.
What was his impact on styling? You had mentioned
it was a very, very heavy impact on styling. He felt that we needed an all new car, could not afford an all new car, so that's why we did the 55, and we took old high pockets, as we called it, because we always felt the belt was too high. And I'm sure John would share that thought today, John Reinhardt, who, by the way, you should talk to also if you haven't. But nice guy. But so when I was working directly for Nance before Bill came in, he asked me the weekend of Easter, the Easter weekend. Now this was in 1954, and in 55 the cars came out early, as you know. There was, I think, an August launch date or something on this thing, and this is in April, would you believe, of 54. So 4 or 5 months later, he wanted to change the back of that car because he had a term, I've got to use a four-letter word here again. He called the taillights on the 54 Packard bull's nuts. That was his little phrase. He was pretty Eddie Murphy-like with his language, too. But he called these things bull's nuts, and he said, Teague, he said, you got to get rid of those GD taillights. He said, they look like hell. He said, it pegs the car as not an all-new automobile. He said, we're not going to be able to call it the new look and all that. He said, you gotta do something about that. He said, why don't you see what you can do over the weekend? This is on a Friday about 4 o'clock, okay? And again, he was very naive about timing. And I said, well, I can make all the drawings you want, but and I can do them this weekend, but you know, whether we can get what I'm gonna do in production by, you know, July and August, I can't answer that. He said, you take care of the drawing, I'll get the sons of bitches made. He said, if I like it. So I went home, and on an Easter Sunday, I lived in an apartment. God, you might call it an apartment. It was upstairs over a vacant lot, as I used to say. It was out on Rochester Road near the Leader Dog out here in Rochester. And so I had nothing to work on. I didn't have a drawing board even at that time, but I had the kitchen table and a little sketch pad and stuff. So I made a drawing, which I still have. I kept that drawing. I'm kind of glad I did, I guess. But I made this drawing of this cathedral taillight. And I took that in there, and I'll tell you, I wasn't in the office 5 minutes Monday morning, the day after Easter, Sunday. But Nance called me. Well, T, what do you got for me? I said, well, I got a drawing. I don't know if you're going to like it or not. I think you will. So he said, bring the son of a bitch up here, and we'll talk about it. I'll get Claire Briggs and Ray Powers, and he said, Bremer, and we'll have a session on it.
Who's that nice person?
Claire Briggs, Bremer, Roger Bremer. Roger Bremer was the guy he brought in. I don't know where they got him, but he was the product planner, the first, that's what his title was, at least, or advanced planner, product planner. So.
Who was Claire Briggs?
Claire Briggs was head of sales, and Ray Powers was head of manufacturing, he and Neil Brown. And so those were, I think Brown was there at that meeting too. So I walked in there with this thing, and geez, he said, that's the best damn drawing. That's fantastic. He went on and on. Honest to God, I fell about 10 feet high. But he really liked that sketch. He said, I want you to go back there to Stanley. He said, I want you to get those guys off their asses. God, we were off our asses. We've been off our asses since he came in. But anyway, he said, get back there. And he said, get that thing in clay. And he said, I want that son of a bitch by the job one. And Jesus Powers is kind of rubbing his head, and Bremer's, nobody wanted to say no to him, you know, he's a new guy on the block, and he was used to doing things in a hurry. And he said, I want to just like Teague's sketch here, he says, and he said, I want to come back, he said, when he gets it in clay, and he said, take a look at it, he said, but it's got to look just like that. He said, that's going to make a, get rid of those GD bull's nuts. And he said, I can't stand those taillights. He says, I'm not going to build the cars, we can't put this taillight on. And he went on and on, and everybody's nodding their head, no problem, sure, we'll do it, Jim. So anyway, to make a long story short, they got those, they pulled all kinds of miracles to get that. I don't know how in the hell, we couldn't do that today. In about 90 days, 120 days, they had those. They were sand castings, admittedly, but they didn't have the ETL problems, you know, the electric, lighting, government lighting standards and requirements. But this thing, yet it, we trimmed the bumper. I knew enough about doing things that I knew it could be done, but the time frame really got me. Trimmed off the bumpers and put the exhaust through the ends of the bumpers and the cathedral taillight, and they, what they did, each one of those things was it was way too late to get tooling for fenders, you know, there's no way, so they chop each fender and they just overlay this thing and let it in around. It was just like a mask going over your face and then letting in the lines. And sure enough, that, and of course, concurrent with those first vehicles, the prototypes so-called, and the early production vehicles, they were tooling the thing for a little more hard tooling than just sand castings, for sure. Mm-hmm. But it at least gave a stepping stone to getting to the 55s, and turned out the 56 too. Of course, taillight is the same. But he sure liked that taillight. He really, everything about that thing. He gave me a raise. I think I was making about $500 or $600 a month at that time. And he gave me about a $200 a month raise and sent me to the Turin Automobile Show. He was so happy with that Sunday afternoon project that I did for him. And, so that was kind of an interesting little anecdote, and really got me on a firm footing with Nance. He thought that was great. He still brought Bill Schmidt in over me, though, which was okay. I didn't know Bill Schmidt from Adams Off Ox at the time, but I'd heard about him, and I knew he was a good man. And so then, you know, 3 or 4 months later, he brought Bill in, and I got along great with Bill. He was no Art Ross. Uh-huh. He was a good guy to work with, and got the most out of people that work for him, which is what you do if you're a good manager, I think. And
but Packard is not making it in the marketplace at this point.
The reason it wasn't making it in the marketplace was merely because, again, NASA's naivete on what it takes to build cars and the time that it takes to get quality into the pieces that you're tooling for, and the development time, just the plain gestation period of going that far, because the problems were so, I don't know how many heart attacks they had per employee in departments down there, but it had to be pretty intense, because styling actually was the easy part of it, but making all of that stuff come true with a suspension system that Allison had to design through the wee hours of the morning and get into production, and getting the pieces and even everything was it started so late. I don't know when they kicked off the 55 program, but it was much earlier. Well, not much earlier, but it was earlier than when I had done the taillights in April. I think it started about the day Nance walked through the door and he saw the proposed 55 Packard, which was basically a facelift of the 54, a very light one. I've still got some photographs of it somewhere. But he just said, "Hey, it's not new enough. We got to have." And on top of that, he wanted carabins. He wanted, hard tops and all sorts of other things that were.
What's a carabin?
Carabin was a convertible version of it. And we had a lot of that because we had, of course, 54 convertibles. But this was an extended back end.
What was your line at this time? Did you identify some of the models that were?
Well, it was a
well remembered.
The Caribbean, of course. It was the that was the top of the line, and it was three tones and all that sort of thing. There was the 400, the Patrician, or the top of the sedan lines, and then there was the 300 series, which was really carried over from 54. And I'm a little fuzzy on remembering all of the different models. I've got the catalogs, of course, today, but. And then, of course, he wanted a Clipper besides, so it just compounded the problem still further. But, of course, the Clipper picked up the 54 taillights and the 55. But the Packard, he was on this kick of splitting the two cars. The Packard, keep that as a Packard, and then keep the Clipper as the low price model, which he did. But and that, of course, got some of the sheet metal offenders and stuff of the senior line, but they're different wheelbases, too. But he was very, very much interested in separating the Packard further away from, that's why the taillights.
Right.
And even though the bull's nuts taillights, so-called, had no relationship at all, appearance-wise, to the Clipper, he still wanted, he didn't like those taillights. From the first time he saw them, they were no good. But the Clipper also, the reception was great. My God, the brochures, Packard's new look and all that stuff that's in the brochures that you can see today in the archives. The advertising, I thought, was superlative. And there was an article in Fortune magazine called Packard's Road Back. And there's pictures of Nance and others. And you might want to, well, I don't know what that has anything to do with me. But it was in Fortune magazine in 54. Packard's Road Back or Road to Recovery or something. That's 54, 55. And we're going to make it and all those great, statements.
Partitory.
Yeah. But
as was Nance very good at that.
Yes, he was. Yeah.
But you have, you can see the handwriting on the wall.
The problems were so intense as far as getting the cars built in 55 because of all of the late releases from engineering and the late releases to purchasing and the people that had to build the pieces, all the suppliers. It was just an impossible task to do it in the time frame that Nance was demanding that we do it in.
Mm-hmm.
And that Connor Street plant where they built these cars was a joke. I don't know who sold Nance on that one. It must have been Ray Powers, I guess, or Neil Brown, or both of the above. But that thing was never meant to be, a volume factory facility. It just couldn't do it. That was where, they were. I remember going by that plant at the height. You wouldn't hardly dare walk in there. You'd become part of the car, because these guys were going nuts over there trying to get these cars out because they'd announced the cars and the dealers were climbing the walls to get them, and the quality was so bad on some of those cars, and things were not really invented yet. I remember Herb Mesh and his engineers working through the night after that when the cars came out and the first snowstorm hit in Detroit here, and they were testing some of the cars, and the salt that they put on, they had plenty of water tests out at Utica, you know, at the proving ground. But for some reason or other, somebody didn't pick up the salt, which got up into the gear reduction system that actuated the torsion suspensions. And those things were shorting out, and the cars were coming through high and low and everything else, and they were not level. You know, they were ass-end high or ass-end low, or both. One car one way and another one the other way, because they were shorting them out, and they worked through the night putting baffles in there and all kinds of protective coverings for the gear system to keep that. But somebody had goofed. In the tremendous haste to get these cars out, they just didn't get all the work done. It wasn't anybody's fault particularly. It was just the time frame was just impossible.
Who was the head of manufacturing? That was
Ray Powers.
Frank Powers.
Ray Powers.
That was Ray Powers. He and Herb Misch were trying desperately to.
Yeah, they were.
Turn out a car that would hold together.
Exactly, and to get the quality in the things, and the quality was so bad, my God, they couldn't. Particularly that suspension system, which was a great system, but it just needed more testing and more time.
Did you say Nash commissioned that from? The suspension system, what was his name?
Bill Allison, who you might want to get on tape at some point.